You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 19th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme coming up.
This famine is not a natural disaster. It's not a flood. It's not a earthquake. It's entirely man-made.
The EU's foreign policy chief says Israel is provoking famine in Gaza. We'll assess whether Josep Borrell's words will hold any traction as Jerusalem denies his accusations. Also ahead, in power until 2030 at least, but after Vladimir Putin, who comes next? We'll examine a sparse list of successors. Terry Stiasny is my guest in the studio to be here with the papers. A very good morning to you, Terry. What have you spotted?
Good morning. Well, Donald Trump's legal and financial troubles are continuing to mount in New York. We'll look at whether artificial intelligence is threatening democracy. And in my neck of the woods, a new Banksy artwork in North London is drawing the crowds.
And we hear about Finland's new border law and enjoy Michelin's new favourites. That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. Japan's central bank has raised its key interest rates from minus 0.1% to 0.1%. That's the first time the cost of borrowing has increased in 17 years in the country. The UN Secretary General has said he is alarmed by reports of airstrikes carried out by Myanmar's military on civilian targets. And Donald Trump has lost his bid to stop two key witnesses in his fraud trial from testifying. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, the United Nations says famine is imminent in northern Gaza. In its latest food security report, the UN warned that a million people, half of the territory's population, were facing starvation. Meanwhile, the UN's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, has accused Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war. Israel has rejected the claim. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined now from Dubai by Greg Karlstrom, who's Middle East correspondent and the author of How Long Will Israel Survive, The Threat from Within. A very good morning to you, Greg. Welcome back to Monocle Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So just to explain the situation for us, there was a stark warning yesterday that people, many of whom are children, are dying from malnutrition. And the assessment is that famine is now imminent.
That's right. There's a body called the IPC. It's a group of international organizations, and it has a technical definition of famine. There are three criteria. It has to do with the number of people who are dying of hunger, a number of people who are malnourished, and then the number of children who are showing signs of wasting because they're not getting enough food. And the IPC said in Gaza, 1.1 million people, half the population, are close to that threshold of famine and may cross it sometime between now and July in the summer. It may be that parts of Gaza already have crossed that threshold, and we just don't know because given the state of the healthcare system in Gaza after almost 6 months of war, it's very tough to assess malnutrition and wasting in children. But whether or not they have crossed that mark, half of the population is close to it, and the IPC says this is both the most acute hunger crisis anywhere in the world right now, and it's also the biggest chunk of a population on the brink of famine since the IPC started doing its work in 2004.
And how limited are food supplies into Gaza?
They're still quite limited. If you look at the statistics from the UN on the number of trucks that are coming into Gaza each day, before the war, there were 500 trucks a day going in. Aid workers say right now they need a minimum of about 300 to provide enough food for Gaza, especially because for months now, it hasn't been anywhere near that level. And so there's a shortage. There's not enough sort of reserves built up in Gaza. If you look at the latest numbers, they haven't come anywhere close to 300 trucks. They've been on better days around 150, 160, 170. On March 16th, a few days ago, only 36 trucks came in carrying food. So still well short of what aid workers say is necessary. And you've had these efforts in parallel to airdrop meals into Gaza or to start bringing them in by sea. But the numbers there are very, very small, just a tiny fraction of the need.
Indeed, there are claims that the air and sea drops are pictorially impressive to the rest of the world, but they're simply not enough. And there are also accusations from aid agencies, aren't there, that Israel is deliberately blocking deliveries by road.
And I think both of those criticisms are accurate. The airdrops to date, you know, they're enough to provide maybe one meal for half of the people in Gaza, this sort of weeks-long effort by the Americans, by other countries, to drop aid in just a very, very small fraction of what is needed. The sea route is not really working yet. There was one delivery so far, but it's going to be a couple of months before the Americans can build this pier they've been talking about and start bringing in larger ships carrying aid. And then, yes, there are still very difficult restrictions bringing aid across the border. You hear every few days about trucks that have been denied entry because they were carrying stethoscopes, because they were carrying flashlights, because they were carrying things that, for whatever reason, the Israelis have on their list of prohibited dual-use goods, as they call them. And when that happens, the truck has to turn around, go back to Egypt or go back to Israel, remove everything, be screened again, turn around again. So there are still very tough restrictions getting things in by land.
So we now have this very stark accusation by the UN foreign policy chief Josep Borrell, who's accusing Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war. This is this astonishing situation that ordinarily famine, when it does strike, is a natural phenomenon, but this is, he is saying, man-made.
It is the IPC, they have said famine, the official definition of famine is quite rare for a country to meet that. It happened in Somalia a couple of decades ago. It happened in South Sudan. It's happened typically in places where there might be a conflict going on, but there is a catastrophic failure of agriculture where you have a couple of bad seasons where there's not enough rain and therefore there's not enough food. What's happening in Gaza, it's remarkable because it's a very tiny place, and a few kilometers away on both sides, you have Israel, which is a very developed economy where there's plenty of food for everybody. And then you have Egypt, which is also a country that has plenty of food available. And that food is just not making it into this very tiny sliver of territory because of political and military decisions that the Israeli government has been making for almost 6 months now.
So how do Borrell's words change things?
I'm not sure they do, to be honest. I think the frustration that he's voicing, it's frustration that you've heard from plenty of other European officials, from UN officials for months and months now. And I think if you look at what's been happening over the past few weeks at countries starting these airdrops, at trying to initiate this sea route and build this pier, I think that shows that the Israeli government is just not interested in ensuring that enough aid comes into Gaza via its land borders, and rather than countries like the United States, which really have meaningful leverage over Israel, rather than those countries using a leverage to force Israel to allow more aid in by land, they're trying to come up with these very convoluted ways to circumvent the land route, to go in by air and by sea, because they are just not interested in using the power that they have to force a policy change by the Israeli government.
Which leaves the external community rather toothless.
It does, rather toothless, and also increasingly responsible for something that Israel ought to be responsible for. It has a moral obligation to make sure that there is enough food and medicine and other supplies going into Gaza. It also, at least in parts of Gaza, has a legal obligation where it is indisputably now an occupying power. In the north of Gaza, for example, there is an obligation under international law for the occupying power to ensure that enough humanitarian supplies are going into the territory. The U.S. and other countries, by trying to come up with these alternative mechanisms, they are absolving Israel of that responsibility, and they are putting the responsibility on themselves for this very difficult logistical operation, this very expensive logistical operation. They are picking up a burden that the Israeli government ought to be picking up.
Israel is denying all this. It bit back hard yesterday. The foreign minister saying that basically saying Josep Borrell should stop attacking Israel and recognise our right to self-defence against Hamas's crimes, saying that Hamas is violently disrupting aid convoys, and that Israel, I think last week, said that it was going to flood Gaza with aid. This now becomes a rather intractable situation, doesn't it? Because as people blame each other for the reasons of the famine seems imminent regardless, and the people who are really being affected this are Gazans themselves, are Palestinians.
That's true. And there's a grain of truth to what the Israelis are saying. Part of the problem with aid is not just getting it into Gaza, but distributing it around Gaza. And you've had many, many cases now of trucks that have been attacked by groups of hungry people in many cases, or by criminal gangs that are starting to form and trying to monopolize these flows of aid within Gaza. So distributing it around the strip has been something that's increasingly difficult to do. It's also something that, in some ways, the Israeli government has helped create that problem, has helped enable that problem by being totally unwilling to talk about sort of the day after, what happens after the war, who is going to secure Gaza, who is going to exercise authority there. That's something that Prime Minister Netanyahu for months now has refused to talk about and refused to put a plan in place. So you have Gaza devolving into anarchy in parts of the strip, and that does make it impossible to distribute aid within the territory, and just adds to what is already a very difficult burden on the borders.
Now, the European Union is close to agreeing sanctions for Israeli settlers attacking Palestinians in the West Bank. How much does that change things?
These are for now very piecemeal sanctions. The Americans so far, the Biden administration has imposed sanctions on seven individual settlers and then on two what are called illegal outposts. So these are settlements that are not only illegal under international law, but also illegal under Israeli law because they were built without the government's approval. That is as far as the Biden administration has gone with sanctions, and I wouldn't expect the Europeans to go much further. And so you can look at that and you can be dismissive and you can say it reduces the settler movement to just a handful of bad apples, so to speak, when in fact, it is something that has enjoyed massive state support for half a century, and sanctioning a few settlers is not meaningfully going to curtail that. But you can also look at it and say it's a first step, and it's a bit remarkable to see America using sanctions at all in this context. And perhaps Joe Biden and perhaps European officials so far are not willing to go further than that, but they're setting a precedent that could be used in the future for further reaching sanctions against not just individuals, but against the settler movement.
And in the meantime, there are these negotiations continuing. What is happening? Because they began again on Sunday, and we had the intelligence agency of Israel, we had the Qatari prime minister, and we had Egyptian officials gathering to examine Hamas's peace proposal, ceasefire proposal. Do we have any sign that there is any developments there?
It is going to be a long process, I think. The Israeli delegation, led by David Barnea, the head of the Mossad, the Israeli spy service, it is in Doha right now. The government says it has been given a broad mandate to pursue these negotiations. There are some specific points in that Hamas proposal that I think the Israeli government is going to want to change. One of them is the number of Palestinian prisoners that Hamas is asking for to be released in exchange for the release of Israeli hostages. And then there are also some questions about this is meant to be a multi-stage process with discussions about a permanent ceasefire to occur in one of the latter stages. And that is not something that the Israeli government is ready to talk about yet. So there are some details that still need to be negotiated. And part of what's going to make this a slow process is anything that the Israelis propose in Doha has to be sent back to the Hamas leadership in Gaza for their approval. It's been very difficult to get in touch with them in recent weeks because they are underground hiding from the Israeli army. So there's going to be a lag in between each proposal from the Israelis and then each response from Hamas.
Greg Karlstrom in Dubai. Thank you so much for joining us on The Globalist. You're listening to Monocle Radio. It's 15:14 in Hong Kong, 7:14 a.m. here in London. Now, a new law is expected to pass in Hong Kong today, which critics say mark a further erosion of human rights. The new security bill, or Article 23, will give authorities more power to minimise protest, protect state secrets and to counter external influences. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined now by Shibani Mattani, who's an international investigative correspondent at The Washington Post and author of Among the Braves, a book about Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement. A very warm welcome to Monocle Radio, Shibani.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
So Article 23 seems quite neat and targeted. However, it's 212 pages long. What is among these pages?
Yeah, absolutely. And so just to, you know, be clear, this is a different security law, right, from the national security law that's already in place from Hong Kong, and actually adds to sort of the security apparatus in Hong Kong with more sort of repressive legislation here. But yeah, I mean, it's very expansive, and it includes basically penalties against treason, against, you know, possessing state secrets, against insurrection, and sort of other sort of security related offenses that, as you say, could be applied not only to protests, but also, for example, to businesses, for due diligence companies, anyone sort of handling material that might fall under this sweeping legislation.
So how much does it change people's ability to move freely, speak freely? And, you know, you talked about legislation affected in businesses there. What are the practical implications?
Yeah, so the reality is Hong Kong has already been transformed by the Beijing-imposed national security law that passed in 2020 in the wake of, you know, protests that were going on for months there, right? And in the past 4 years, Hong Kong has really become a very muted, very suppressed city with very, very limited space for public dissent, if at all. And, you know, the passage, the really fast passage of the law sort of emphasizes that, right? This same bill was actually on the table in 2003, and there were massive protests against it. There was a lot of opposition, and it failed. But today you see it being fast-tracked. You see the legislature just kind of speeding it through, lawmakers saying this is a historic milestone, celebrating this as a huge achievement for Hong Kong, right? Which again, is indication to the fact that there really is no opposition that is substantive or is allowed to sort of operate there in Hong Kong. And so on top of that, right, they're adding, you know, more and more ways, right, that people can be sort of targeted against for basic, you know, freedom of speech.
Why is there this extra layer then, in addition to what comes from mainland China?
Yeah, I think the idea is that, you know, Article 23 was something that Hong Kong has an obligation to pass under, you know, its constitution and so on. And so that's obviously part of it, right? I think there's this idea that in Hong Kong that the lawmakers want to show Beijing that they're doing such a good job maintaining and upholding, right, this security infrastructure already in place in Hong Kong. But I also think the idea that a place can never be fully, quote unquote, secure, right, is very hard to achieve a sort of guarantee, right? And so even with the existing national security legislation, I believe that the Hong Kong government still thinks that there's room for them to sort of further legislate against stuff like sedition, against stuff like treason, which may not be covered under the existing law, right? But it's really sort of fortifying this apparatus against any potential criticism and giving the police, giving the government, giving, you know, the Hong Kong as a whole, right, more ways to kind of crack down on perceived dissent.
It's being pushed through fairly fast, and an article in South China Morning Post suggested that this is to push foreign powers off guard and to push protesters off guard.
Well, the protesters would have never been really able to be on guard anyway, right, given that a vast majority of them are in jail related to offences under the national security law, right? I think the speed of it really is to kind of indicate to Beijing that, you know, Hong Kong's got this under control, and also the speed of it's because Hong Kong can rush through these laws now. They have no opposition. There's no dissenting opinion. There's no one to push back, right? So I think it's also a function, you know, of that. And, you know, how the international community responds, I guess we'll wait and see. But I think there's also this idea that, you know, the national security law was kind of the worst thing that could have happened, right? I mean, the response to that, some sanctions from the US and so on. I think Hong Kong feels like, well, whatever they already faced from there was probably the worst, right? And actually, maybe there's not going to be that much more opposition with this one.
And when it does come to the international community, and you have obviously a almost one-way journey that Hong Kong is taking, countries can react and criticise and condemn, but ultimately it's also the private sector and businesses which must decide whether it is in their best interests to stay, to invest, or indeed to promote business in Hong Kong. What's happening there?
Exactly. And I think that's a really key point. You know, Article 23, in sort of debating or proposing it, the Hong Kong government has said, oh, this is a way to stabilize, you know, the city and to make sure that we have no national security threats and business feels safe and comfortable here. I mean, in reality, it's the total opposite, right? I mean, the first reason that Hong Kong's economy is suffering is because of the economy on the mainland, right? Which the two places are obviously incredibly tied together. But the second reason is a lot of businesses that deal with anything sensitive, for example, data storage, for example, you know, tech companies like, you know, Google and so on, have long since the protests in the national security law in 2020 been making contingencies, right? And actually, you know, I'm based here in Singapore, which has seen a lot of companies, a lot of decision makers move to the city precisely because they feel less secure operating in Hong Kong. Obviously, there's some businesses for whom, you know, Hong Kong and mainland China will always be so attractive that they, you know, will factor that into their plans, right? But for anyone who has to deal with anything sensitive, especially due diligence companies, right, which have been facing a lot of threats and pressure within mainland China, they're going to be thinking the same now in Hong Kong, right, because the jurisdictions are starting to meld together in a way that they were never supposed to.
Shiboni Mutani, thank you so much, as ever, for joining us on Monocle Radio. Still to come on today's programme.
Be our guest, be our guest, put our service to the test. Tie your napkin round your neck, sherry, and we provide the rest. Soup du jour, hot hors d'oeuvre, why we only live...
We will be looking at the latest Michelin Guide to French Cuisine. Stay with us on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Let's continue now with today's newspapers. I'm delighted to say that joining me in the studio is author and political journalist Terry Stiesny. A very good morning, Terry.
Good morning.
How are things?
Things are very well, thank you.
We're quite excited that you've got a Banksy in your ish neighbourhood, so we'll come to that in a minute. I mean, everyone dreams of a Banksy in the neighbourhood. But tell us what you found in the papers.
Well, yeah, let's look at the New York Times first. And they are reporting on Donald Trump's continuing sort of legal and financial woes. And this is the latest report that his lawyers have had to go to court and say he's been told he's got to pay $454 million in his civil fraud case, or he's at least got to put up a bond for that amount of money. And he and his team have asked around. They have asked 30 different companies through some brokers, and nobody, despite diligent efforts, apparently, has said that they would stump up the money for him. And his lawyers say that he has encountered insurmountable difficulties in coming up with this money. So the question is really, what happens next? I mean, he's due to pay this money over in a week's time. The reports here that he might have a financial crisis if he can't raise it. He's trying to appeal against this. But the question is where it goes from here, because this report in the New York Times is suggesting that he doesn't have enough liquid assets to pay the bond. Remember, he's already had to pay out $91 million, in a similar bond in the other case, in the E.J. and Carroll case. This is his the case about his property. And, you know, it's conceivable that his companies might have to post bankruptcy, because, of course, you know, part of the problem with this particular case is that, you know, his companies aren't now, he's not allowed to be a director of a company in New York. So, you know, if you're a company looking at this, are you going to stump up money for Donald Trump and they've just said you can't do business in New York, then you're not going to want to deal with him.
One wonders who will stump up the money, because there will be plenty of backers and plenty of fans of Donald Trump who've poured money into his campaign to be re-elected as president. It's almost inconceivable to that Donald Trump would run out of cash.
Well, yeah, or is it? I mean, you know, the question is, you know, how much money does he really have? How much cash does he actually have available? And this is all, you know, shrouded in mystery. But, you know, his campaign, obviously, you know, of coming out fighting against this. I mean, the statement here, I'll just read you. It said, this is a motion to stay the unjust, unconstitutional, un-American judgment from New York Judge Arthur Engoron in a political witch hunt brought by a corrupt attorney general, said a spokesman, who was not holding back there.
Of course, always a witch hunt. Right. Let's move to an interesting article in Politico about recruitment and retainment of members of the military.
Yes, we're hearing a lot at the moment about, particularly about conscription in Europe, about how we fund the military in Europe. But Politico has dived quite deep here into the trouble is not so much, it says here, recruiting new soldiers, but about persuading existing troops not to quit. So obviously, you know, given the situation in Ukraine, this is a big hot topic. Germany has looked around. The German parliament said that 1,500 soldiers left the Bundeswehr last year. The French armed forces are having a problem with soldiers. They're joining, but they're not wanting to stay. So they're staying on average a year less than they used to. The UK has got a hiring shortfall. And so apart from the idea of having conscription or possibly bringing back conscription, which some countries are doing, so you haven't got volunteers, you've got people who have to go and join the military, they're trying to make this a bit more enticing. So, for instance, the French army are saying you get a better pension, you get better salary, you might get better housing. And this is another problem for the armed forces, is that people just saying, you know, you're not paying us enough to do all of this in a risky time. And why would you join the military if, you know, your housing's not great, your healthcare's not great, your childcare's not great, and all the other perks of the job are not what they might have been.
I remember I was lucky enough a few years ago to go to Denmark to look at women and their role on the front line. And I remember there they had absolutely no difficulty recruiting women, because obviously when we have equality on the front line, then women fight shoulder to shoulder with men. But none of them stayed more than the 4 months that they were allowed to, or they didn't stay long enough. And as a result, there was a sense that actually there was a sort of a long-term problem from within the military, that if you can't retain people, then how can you build a good battalion? How can you have a sort of a sense of a team there? This is a sort of a fundamental problem of kind of like how a team works, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. And so Poland's announcing you're giving a pay rise of 20% to try and retain troops. French plan saying, you know, you've got to help people with things like healthcare and childcare, and saying that if you're a couple who are both in the armed forces, even if one of you is a civilian, you would be able to transfer for posts together. Because obviously, yeah, it's upheaval, you know, in the past people might have been quite more willing to sacrifice and say, right, you know, you're going away for 6 months on a tour of duty. But people seem, you know, understandably reluctant to do that now.
Let's have a look at the front of the Financial Times. The dangers of artificial intelligence, again, it seems to be a perpetual front page everywhere. What's the latest story that people are covering on this?
Well, the latest story here in the Financial Times is saying that there's been an agreement between groups of scientists, both Western and Chinese scientists, who are looking at AI, and they met in Beijing last week, and they're saying we need to have red lines, which are about the development of AI, particularly about bioweapons and cyber attacks. And they're actually comparing this, interestingly, to the Cold War. So they're saying that we need to cooperate with scientists from other countries, saying that in the depths of the Cold War, international scientific and governmental coordination helped avert thermonuclear catastrophe, and humanity, and again, needs to coordinate to avert a catastrophe that could arise from unprecedented technology. So they're really, these are quite strong terms.
Yes,
here.
What kind of catastrophe are we talking about here? What could possibly go wrong?
Well, this is a good question. I mean, I think they seem to be very worried about whether AI might develop some kind of weapons, whether it could start launching attacks. You know, it starts sort of, I suppose, maybe the idea is that AI, you know, overrides human controllers. And they're saying that AI systems shouldn't be able to copy or improve itself without explicit human approval and assistance. But this does seem to be a thing that is worrying people around the world.
This goes back to, I think it was in January this year, that the US said that it would work with China on the safety of artificial intelligence, that I think they signed a thing called the Bletchley Park Agreement. That's a British agreement on standards for technology. But when one looks at the track record of what happens when you start to either share or collaborate or cooperate between Western countries, nations, and China. It doesn't always end well. There is generally the sense that China claims, becomes protectionist, and then the West gets chucked out.
Well, I think, yes, there is a sort of lack of mistrust on the human level as well. And, you know, it's interesting as well, just looking at a report on Reuters, so the British Deputy Prime Minister, Britain has been trying to, as you say, do summits on this. And there is a summit for democracy in Seoul in South Korea, where they're trying to get governments as well as tech companies to agree on AI risks to elections. And obviously, with so many big elections coming up this year, this is a bit of a worry here. And, you know, they are saying that there are, you know, challenges from AI to democracy and to the running of elections as well.
Actually, that reminds me, yesterday on The Globalist, we were covering the Seoul Democracy Conference. And at one stage, our correspondent was saying that the sum total of people attending online was 47. Finally, let's. I mentioned your Banksy. Well, not your Banksy.
No, certainly not my own Banksy.
It's more your Banksy than it is anybody else's at this precise minute. So tell us about
it's
your
my,
Banksy.
My neighbourhood Banksy. Well, it's a little bit up the road from me. This is in Finsbury Park in North London. And overnight, suddenly a new Banksy appeared. And the way it works, just describing the images of this is quite tricky. So there's a tree next to a block of flats, and the tree has been cut right back. So it looks just like sort of stark branches, and Banksy, for it is he has officially confirmed it, has painted a whole load of green paint on the wall behind it so that it kind of looks as though the tree is in leaf. And there's also an image of a woman holding a pressure washer as though she's been, the woman on the painted on the building has been spraying this paint to sort of create these leaves, as it were. And apparently I haven't been up there yet myself. It's about sort of probably 10-15 minutes away on the bus, but everybody has been, North London has been flocking to go and look at this, because they're such, you know, it's always a big event when a Banksy arrives. And a few years ago, we had one on a road even nearer to me, and, you know, it disappeared quite quickly after a while. They covered it up with plastic. It was the image of people saluting a Tesco bag on a flagpole.
It was incredible. It was incredible when one of the comments that I read yesterday wasn't, how good is this, how blah, blah, blah. And it's an excellent piece of art if you stand from a distance. It doesn't work close up, but it works if you're a long way away,
because all that relative to the tree, yeah.
The green splodges do look like sort of very, very vibrant sort of green leaves. And apparently he's chosen the same green as the local council uses to issue warning signs.
Yes, I love the responses to this. So in The Guardian here, they've talked to local residents and people who've come out to see the artwork yesterday. And people say, I think it's probably one of his biggest pieces in a while. And the fact he's done it on the wall means it can't just be stolen. But the council gave a statement saying the council graffiti removal team is aware of the artwork and will not remove it.
Terry Stiasny, thank you so much for joining me in the studio. You're listening to Monocle Radio. It's The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A quick look now at what else we're keeping an eye on today. Japan's central bank has raised its key interest rates from -0.1% to 0.1%. The overhaul marks the first time the cost of borrowing has increased in 17 years. Wages have jumped and consumer prices have risen. The UN Secretary General says he's alarmed by reports of airstrikes carried out by Myanmar's military on civilian targets. There are unconfirmed reports that more than 20 people were killed and 30 injured when a fighter jet dropped a bomb on a predominantly Rohingya village. Donald Trump has lost his bid to stop two key witnesses in his fraud trial from testifying. The former US president argued that his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, was likely to lie under oath, and that Stormy Daniels, a former porn star, would use the trial to make money. Mr. Trump has pleaded not guilty to 34 counts of falsifying his business records to cover up the payment of hush money to Ms. Daniels. And the head of the gaming regulator in the Philippines has said up to $6 billion will be invested in the country's casino sector in the next 5 years. At least one new casino resort is expected to be opened every other year as the country pushes its status among Asia's top gambling destinations. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, nothing lasts forever. Although, if you live in Russia, it may not feel that way when it comes to Vladimir Putin's grip on the Kremlin. With a strong message being sent to both Russians and the outside world that President Putin has no intention of going anywhere, there seems little point in discussing a potential successor. But Vladimir Putin will be 77 years old by the end of his fifth term in 2030. So who, if anyone, is waiting in the wings? Well, we're joined now by Mark Galeotti, a political analyst and author of Putin's Wars from Chechnya to Ukraine. He's also written an article on the successors, the potential successors to Vladimir Putin. A very good morning to you, Mark. Welcome back.
Good morning. Good to be here.
So just explain to us, this weekend was very much being used as a sign to both Russians and the outside world that Vladimir Putin is going nowhere.
Yes, absolutely. In some ways, the fact that the election was so blatantly rigged, and it's worth noting that surveys before the actual election were giving him between 55 and 66% of the vote. Clearly enough to win, but nothing like the 87% that he eventually sort of was anointed with. In some ways, the very scale of the rigging is precisely that. It's basically a declaratory statement that says, yes, of course we are in power. Yes, of course we will stay in power, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Indeed. I mean, what's the likelihood that he will ever step down, or are we looking at someone who will be carried out feet first?
I suspect that's likely to be the case now. Before his February of 2022 invasion of Ukraine, I think that he was actually toying with options to escape from a job, which in many ways he actually regards as quite irksome. He wants all the perks of the position, but I think he's beginning to get bored with the actual job of running the country. Now, though, he cannot possibly do that, given how the disastrous impact of this war will mean that any successor inevitably will be tempted to use him as the scapegoat. And so essentially, I think he's now stuck.
And internally, you've written about the fact that those who do surround him are not 100% content with this situation, that in fact, the way that the war against Ukraine is going isn't going well at all. And the fact that Vladimir Putin has decided that he's rooting himself in the Kremlin is not the way that they want things to go.
No, I think what we have to draw a distinction between is Putin's own generation. And remember, most of the people around Putin who he's closest to are in the age range 68 to 74. You know, they are basically clinging on to power with both hands. But then you've got, you know, the majority of the senior elite who are 50-somethings and 60-somethings, who are not only wondering when are they going to have their place in the sun, but also have a longer time span. And they're looking at how, in order to fight the war today, Putin is ruining Russia's chances tomorrow. And it is clear there is considerable dissatisfaction there. But again, there is a limit to what they can do so long as Putin has his iron grip on the security apparatus.
So who are these people waiting in the wings?
Well, I mean, to be honest, it's almost everyone. I mean, there's the figures who are essentially technocrats, such as the Prime Minister, Mikhail Mishustin, who would step in as interim president if something happened to Putin. People like Moscow Mayor Sobyanin. Look, these are people who, you know, in broad terms, they are pragmatic kleptocrats. They're not interested in some kind of grand ideological war with the West. They're interested in being able to essentially steal with impunity and enjoy the perks thereof. These are the people who are sort of around. But again, because these are not people that Putin can trust, he's not willing to actually allow power to shift to them.
What about those who are close to him already? I mean, there's mention of the name Sergei Kiryenko. His name has bubbled up to the surface quite recently. Who is he and why would he be someone who we should look at?
Kiryenko is an interesting figure because when we first saw him, he was actually regarded as essentially a liberal. He was a very briefly prime minister. He seemed to be a reformist, not necessarily a liberal in political and social terms, but certainly in economic terms. But he's thoroughly reinvented himself now as some kind of hyper-patriot. He's not only the guy who basically stage-managed these elections, he's also in charge of the occupied territories in Ukraine. And one of the big things that we need to be watching out for is at the moment he's the first deputy head of the presidential administration, essentially Putin's own office. If he moves across, say, becomes a first deputy prime minister or similar, that will be a sign that he's definitely on the move up the political system. So in a way, it's going to be this next week or so where we're actually going to possibly see some interesting shifts within the upper hierarchy of the government.
You mentioned a moment ago there are new generations coming through, and there is this new generation of oligarchs, isn't there? The children of those close to Putin, but those who are being given the opportunity to snap up the international businesses that have left Russia post invasion of Ukraine, who are now going to be finding themselves in position, almost in a complete rerun of what happened with the collapse of the Soviet Union, when the power and business power falls into the hands of very few. Who are they?
Yes, this is interesting because they may not be oligarchs yet. Perhaps we could think of them as mini-garchs. But it's clear that Putin, now that he's obviously thinking in terms of staying in power long term, and as he's aware of the rumblings of discontent within the sort of the next political generation down, he's trying to leapfrog them. He's reaching out to this slightly younger generation, sort of 40-somethings, let's say, both in the political system, but also in business. And he's more or less making this deal. If you show yourself as being hyper-loyalist, we will accelerate your movement up the political chain, or we will make sure that you get to take over businesses that are currently being sequestered in occupied territories or former Western assets or whatever. So in some ways, he's basically setting up I don't want to call it a class struggle, but more of a generational struggle between the current big beasts and the wannabe big beasts who are waiting in the wings. And that, I mean, on the one hand, it's a good recipe for holding power. Putin's very good at divide and rule politics, it has to be said. But it also is a recipe for some serious internal divisions within the political system.
Mark Galeotti, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. It's 9:40 in Helsinki, 8:40 in Zurich. Now, Finland has found itself in a difficult situation when it comes to dealing with its neighbour, Russia. Not only because of a serious security threat following Moscow's invasion of Ukraine, that was helped by Finland joining NATO, but also because of the 1,300-kilometre-long border between the two nations. Moscow has been accused of pushing asylum seekers in Finland's direction, but now Finland is trying to stop it. Well, Petri Bertsov is Monocle's Helsinki correspondent, but just so happens to join me in the studio now. A very good morning to you, Petri.
Good morning, Emma. And I can think of no better way of spending my early morning than being here in the studio with you.
Yes, because we must diverge momentarily from the reason why you are here. And I don't know whether this is sort of bursting the fourth wall, but we have been doing interviews together for what, years? A very, very long time.
7 years.
6, 7 years. We have never met. Mm. And this is the first time that Petri Bertsov and I are in a studio together. And we're both, I'm quite thrilled. I'm delighted, Petri. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And right, okay. I've forgotten what we were talking about now. Yes, we're talking about the border, and we're talking about the fact that Russia is pushing asylum seekers across it. What is Finland trying to do to stop it?
So the government plans to introduce a new border law that would be the strictest so far. It would basically allow the government to stop receiving asylum applications. That's what every country has to do under international law. When an asylum seeker crosses the border, manages to cross the border, then you have to let that asylum seeker apply for asylum. So the new law would basically allow Finland not to receive, and the term they use is pushback. So they would be allowed to push the asylum seekers back into Russia in this case.
And tell us a little bit about what kind of people we're talking about here.
So these are people who actually, most of them have a legitimate claim to get asylum. They're from countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, countries from Syria and countries like that, but who have stayed, you know, they're not coming directly from those countries. They've stayed in Russia for quite a long time, but still they are, you know, they are legitimate asylum seekers. But what the Finnish government is saying is that, and this is actually what the Finnish Central Criminal Police is also saying, that some of them might be a criminal risk in Finland. But, I mean, it's also secretive. We don't really know. I mean, they haven't released any details. So for us journalists, it's really hard to sort of fact-check any of that. And it's easy, of course, let's remember, Finland has a far-right government. It's easy for any far-right government to say that, look, you know, they are these people, immigrants, they're just a security threat, so we cannot let them in. And now the Finnish authorities are saying the same. I mean, mind you, not all of them, but some of them. And that's the justification that the government uses for this new law.
It's becoming quite a contentious subject, isn't it? Because there are risks that actually, if you do start to push back, you're breaking some fairly fundamental principles and laws.
Absolutely. And there's already talk that the European Court of Human Rights will have to take up this case because it's also against the European Convention of Human Rights. So Finland is setting an interesting precedent in this regard, because let's remember, I mean, as we've discussed on these shows before, obviously current sort of laws with regards to asylum seeking and asylum seekers, they were written in a time when there wasn't instrumentalized migration, the stuff that Russia now does. So a lot of people are also saying that we need to update these laws to somehow be able to react to what Russia is doing.
How genuine a problem is this in Finland? I mean, one hears of governments, increasingly on the far right, who talk about in very, very violent terms and vivid terms about the threats from those who come from abroad. I mean, is this a genuine issue in Finland? Or is this a government, as you say, on the far right, that has decided that it can use this as an opportunity?
Well, that's the thing. We cannot know. I mean, obviously, you don't see it in the street. You don't see criminal gangs of migrants. That's ridiculous. I mean, if let's say that this was just ordinary asylum seekers from those countries that I mentioned, the numbers in themselves would not be an issue at all. We're talking a few thousand. You know, Finland can easily, as a rich European country, manage all of that. But then, I mean, the government has said that there are hundreds of people who are a criminal risk. So, you know, if that is true, and again, I repeat, there's no way to know. We don't have access to the police files. But if that's true, then, you know, that is significant.
Tell us more generally about how Finland's border has changed since Russia invaded Ukraine. I mean, we hear reports of people, you know, of border towns where cultures have found themselves in a bit of a problem, that actually they've been, you know, doing happy daily business with what is effectively now the enemy. And then you have Russians trying to get over in cars and finding Finland as a sort of like the poorest border out of the country. I mean, what is Finland doing now to try and manage this?
Well, the life on the border has changed completely. I visited some of the border towns, for example, this town called Lappeenranta, which is close to the border, which before the war, you know, a lot of the people living in that town had visas that they could cross the border and go into Russia anytime. And then the Russian town on the other side, they had similar visas. Now, that doesn't happen anymore. And I mean, I always remember when this one entrepreneur in Lappeenranta told me that the way they see it, St. Petersburg, a city of 5 million people, is closer to them geographically than Helsinki, a city of 500,000 people. So also in a business sense, this has been quite a major blow to these towns.
Petri Bertsov, thank you so much for joining me in the studio. On The Globalist, you're listening to Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter, to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's time now to talk aviation. Murdo Morrison is head of strategic content at Flight Global. I'm delighted to say Murdo joins me on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hope all is well in aviation. Well, actually, just tell us what is happening, because it is a strange state of affairs when the national broadcaster, the BBC, has an enormous thing about saying, what is wrong with Boeing? This has become a global mainstream headline, hasn't it?
It has, and it's a real problem for Boeing. I mean, it's been a problem for Boeing you could argue since 2019, since the first crash that subsequently after the second one led to the grounding. And, you know, Boeing this seems to be nothing going right for Boeing at the moment. The FAA, the regulator in the States, is looking at them amid all these worries about quality control. That comes after the incident on the 737, the Alaska Airlines one, where the door plug fell out in midair. I mean, just shocking incidents that really have, you know, and Boeing is an enormous company, so important to the U.S. economy and the aerospace chip industry. And for serious question marks to be asked about, you know, around Boeing's quality control is really quite worrying. And it's a serious structural systemic problem that Boeing is really going to have to address. And how it does that, it's not even just a case of replacing CEOs, replacing boards. It's a huge cultural problem. I think it's really wrestling with at the moment.
Indeed. I mean, in terms of the cultural problem that it has, the idea of safety being seen as a secondary consideration was highlighted, as you say, after 2019, when you had the 737 MAX crashes. At that time, Boeing said that it was going to start again. It was going to go back to its old values of being the best, of making sure that its safety was at its core. But as someone who's been following aviation for a very long time, Murdo, how surprised were you that Boeing was still getting it so wrong?
Well, it was very surprising because, as you say, in aviation, you have to be, there is no less than 100%. When it comes to safety. And Boeing, of course, has been hit as well by the other problems in the industry, the supply chain problems, the difficulties it's got trying to ramp up its production to meet demand. Because people are still buying Boeing aircraft, don't forget. So it's not a company, it's a company in crisis, but it's not a company that's going out of business. There's still strong demand for its products.
And indeed, it is thinking about acquiring one of its suppliers. I mean, how wise an idea is that? Tell us about Spirit AeroSystems.
Spirit AeroSystems used to be part of Boeing until 20 years ago and was divested at a time when there was talk about Boeing and its competitors, Airbus, you know, becoming almost like Apple, like a branding company that would do engineering design and outsource everything else. Of course, that's not happened. In fact, we've gone full circle. Now, companies like Boeing are looking at possibly buying back key suppliers such as Spirit AeroSystems, just to give them control of that the next tier down in their production system, their supply chain. But of course, that would cost them money at a time when Boeing hasn't got money. Would it necessarily make it any better at Spirit AeroSystems, which is also a company having quality control problems according to the FAA? So lots of questions around it, lots of doubt as to whether it will actually happen.
Let's bring back the age-old discussion as to whether long-haul low-cost actually works. It is one of those things that there are case studies that come and go that operators try to make it work and don't always make it work. There's been another casualty or there's been another twist in the last few weeks, hasn't
there? Yes, a change of the CEO has departed at one of the... the Icelandic airline Play, a low-cost airline. I don't think there's too much to be read into that particularly, but I think it raises the whole question about the sustainability of that model. And as you say, it's been ever since Freddie Laker in the 1970s, people have been trying to do low-cost transatlantic. Play followed on from another Icelandic airline called WOW that were offering low-cost transatlantic with using Iceland as a staging post, a bit like Icelandair do as well. So Europe to North America on narrow-body aircraft, but stopping in Iceland. Now, they've done quite well. They've got quite a good reputation. The other airline trying to do this is Norse Atlantic, which sort of inherited the long-haul fleet, transatlantic fleet from Norwegian. Again, you know, I've flown with them. Great service, particularly in premium economy. But, you know, like all these airlines, they have the problem of... you know, it's difficult to scale that business in the quiet periods in winter. It's difficult to generate enough cash to meet all your overheads. And of course, you're up against huge brands, you know, the huge airline brands where you're having to sort of compete with that sort of marketing. So it's very, very difficult for that business model to work. You know, whether it's sustainable long term, I think we still have to see. The jury's still out. But, you know, there will always be new entrants. There will always be casualties in that business, I think.
Madam Morrison, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. The latest Michelin Guide is out, ranking France's most prized restaurants. And Chiara Ramella is Confex deputy editor and the host of The Menu on Monocle Radio. I'm delighted to say she joins us on the line now. Very good morning to Chiara.
And to you, Emma. It's a joy.
It is a joy. Now, so, and it's a joy to talk about food. So tell us about the what is happening in the world of Michelin. Because what's quite fun is that they announced who lost everything last week to try not to distract from the brilliant new shining stars. What are we noticing in what Michelin's looking for at the moment?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? That's proper fair play, just leaving 1 week for people to lick their wounds. Yesterday was a time for celebration for 62 restaurants who were awarded at least one new star, which is quite a lot. It's a very large number of new restaurants, 52 of those getting one star, the rest above. 23 of those only opened in the last year, which again is quite remarkable. Bit of a gamble because sometimes in 1 year, it's difficult to understand whether you have achieved that consistency that famously is one of the hallmarks of getting a Michelin star. But I think overall, what most people have been focusing about is the fact that quite a lot of the new awardees are under 40. So Michelin are calling this a sign of the cultural dynamism, so they call it, of the French scene. I suppose it's a step in the right direction because in many very occasions, Michelin have been accused of kind of representing a more traditional approach to fine dining, even though we've become quite accustomed with the kind of the high-end foamy side of Michelin dining. It's not quite stopped making the list. But there is, I suppose, an attempt to celebrate newer talent that's coming through the ranks. And a lot of this new talent tends to be or seems to be influenced also by experiences abroad or international influences in the food, which I think is where a lot of quite interesting things are happening in the French scene.
We'll start talking about the international influences in a moment, but I'm keen to address this foamy side of French cuisine, which I suppose has been the traditional view, perhaps not from within France, which is moving fast, and Paris in particular. But when one thinks of French cuisine, unlike high-end cuisine from many other countries, there is a stiffness to it and a sense of formality. And also it harks back to those days of us and our parents going to restaurants and being told that they're wrong, or that they, you know, that they are ignorant and they are sort of having to step up. How much does that culture still exist, you believe, inside, you know, the high-end Michelin world?
Well, I think this is really tricky because we're seeing so many more exciting restaurants getting Michelin stars that are so not the kind of Michelin star that you perhaps would have associated in your head some years ago. I mean, here in London, Chishuru recently won a Michelin star, and that's just such a fundamental representation of what the Michelin star can still mean. I think that in terms of the interpretation of French food, this is really tricky because I think it depends whether you're looking at it from within France, from outside France. You know, inside France, Michelin is very keen to say that they're not just celebrating tradition, but also innovation, and that that French cuisine is moving past almost this burden of influence because they feel like tradition is very heavy. But then at the same time, when you look at the most interesting French-inspired restaurants outside of France, many of them are going back to a very, very classic version of French food, the proper old-school bistro. So what perhaps France wants to move away from is what the rest of the world wants to go back to. And inside France, where do you find that balance between not just going back to the old school bistro that everybody stereotypically knows how to recognize, but at the same time also not go for that other stereotype of French cuisine, which you were talking about, which is starched tablecloth and I guess the platonic ideal of the super-starred Michelin restaurant.
Yes, we got it wrong when the minute you sit down. briefly, and we've got a matter of seconds to talk about new international influences. I mean, immediately you think of Maurice Sacco, who, born in Paris, has Malian heritage, yet embraces French, African and Japanese cuisine, at pains not to describe it as fusion, but very much an example of how French food is moving.
Yeah, definitely. I think that there are plenty of restaurants in this list that show influences from Africa, from Japan. And I think that this is obviously an amazing, great sign. The one little note of disappointment is that only 6 female chefs were awarded a star on Monday. So let's hope that next year's list kind of reflects a bit more of that excitement in the kitchen as well.
Chiara Romella, thank you as ever for joining us on The Globalist. And that's all the time we have for today's programme. The warmest of thanks to all my guests and to our producers too, Chris Chermak, Christy O'Grady and Monica Lillis. Our researcher was George Ruskin and our studio manager was Steph Chungu. After the headlines, more music on the way, and The Briefing is live at midday in London. Chris Chermak is your host for that. The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. For now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.